Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by Christopher Cotter and myself, David Robertson. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com. So today we're here in New York with Benjamin Beitelami, who has been studying the psychology of religion for over 40 years, written a number of books, I've been quite influential on my studies so far, so I'm very pleased to be here. So first of all, thank you for joining us. Just to start, I mean, before we even talk about the psychology of religion, what is psychology?
Well, psychology, I followed a very simple textbook definition that says that psychology is an effort to explain and predict human behavior and human consciousness.
So, with that in mind, then, how is psychology generally applied to the study of religion? I mean, how can we do it?
Well, religion is behavior, mm-hmm. and it's consciousness, and basically it's observable. People tell us all sorts of things. People engage in particular kinds of behaviors that are unique to religion. And so we observe these behaviors and we ask questions. And the question is, of course, how can we explain religion? Why do people engage in these kinds of behaviors? Why do people tell us certain stories? And I think what is unique about the psychology of religion is that, you know, we have, at last count, 60,000 religions in the world,
wow.
if not more. So there are plenty of religions around. And we, as psychologists, should be focusing and are focusing on the common denominator. In other words, the outward differences are not very important to us.
Okay.
They are very important to religious people. And religious people are going to object, of course, when we just say that you're just one of 60,000, because everybody who's religious believes that their religion is, of course, special and unique and superior and the absolute truth, and we know that. That's part of our data. But we look at the common denominator, and when we try to explain religion and religious behavior and religiosity, we are looking at this common denominator. In other words, we are not working on any particular religion, because very often people, especially lay people, ask, do you specialize in Christianity or Islam? No, we don't specialize in any particular religion, because we are looking at the structure, the basic structure, the basic content, just like linguists want to find the general rules of language. And it doesn't matter, and they believe, and we believe, perhaps mistakenly, that we are going to find the common structures that create the behavior, that create this phenomenon of 60,000 religions.
Okay. I'm going to jump off script, or I think I'm jumping into another part of my script, actually, here, because everyone who studies religion comes across the problem of how do you define the religion. So a lot of your work that I've read has been about atheists. So do they have religion or?
No, I think that if you're an atheist, you don't have religion. That's very clear. And people do have, again, most of humanity does have religion, does follow a particular kind of religion. And this means that most human beings believe that in addition to this world, in which we are born, we suffer, and then we die, there's another world, the world of the spirits. And not only that, and this is here I'm following William James, and there's a famous quotation from William James that I use in more than one of my books. I use it in every book because it's so wonderful. And he speaks about the unseen order that people, religious people, consider very, very important, to life in this world. In other words, there's another world, but we get messages from the other world, the world of the spirits, and the world of the spirits is inhabited by gods, angels, demons, and human souls. That's one thing that all religions agree on. So if you're religious, you believe in this invisible world, but you believe in a very particular version. In other words, one religion says there are 800 gods, another religion says there are 1,000 gods or one god. It doesn't really matter, I think, to me, but they all agree that there is another world and that we have to relate to it and we negotiate. I say that religious practices are really negotiations with the world of the spirits.
Okay.
So atheists don't negotiate with the world of the spirits. So that's what they don't do.
According to them, maybe.
According to that, well, we can ask them, but what happens is that, there's this claim that you hear sometimes that this guy is supposedly an atheist, but deep inside, he's a believer. So this kind of claim, I can also apply to religious people and say, these people claim to be religious, but deep inside, they're atheists. So I don't make these kinds of arguments because in psychology, we don't read minds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we do actually. There is some very interesting work in brain imaging. about fMRI and MRI, where we try to read minds, and it's very interesting. I think very important. But I take seriously what people tell me, and they want me to take seriously what they tell me. So if somebody tells me that he believes in this god or that god, or he's had visions and he's seen angels, I report it as behavior, because verbal reports are also behavior.
Okay. And so then you just touched on there the distinction between psychology, psychological approaches, and then cognitive science. So some people might
I don't see any problem.
I
don't see the difference, because I think the cognitive science people are making psychological claims.
Mm.
So I think that the cognitive approaches that have developed over the past 20 years are part of the psychology of religion, as far as I'm concerned. They do different things, in a sense, they focus on certain concepts, but this is all consistent with psychology. It's a psychological approach. They talk about the brain, okay? They talk about certain psychological mechanisms that make likely the appearance of religion in evolutionary terms, okay? And I think that what they do is very important, and this is exactly what I'm interested in, so there's no problem.
Okay.
And it's like everything, people, in terms of disciplines, people from different disciplines make contributions to the psychology of religion, but some of these people are psychologists, even officially, like Jesse Bering, right? And you have some anthropologists, but these anthropologists work with psychological concepts, and they assume psychological mechanisms and neurological mechanisms, brain mechanisms.
Okay. So this all sounds quite scientific to me. I'm from religious studies, which, it's a social science, but this sounds a bit more scientific. How do people like me, or even more towards the humanities end, how do we engage with this kind of scientific discipline? Is there a divide there?
Well, you'll never catch me using the term scientific, okay?
Okay.
I never talk about anything being scientific. I never talk about science or non-science. This is not my concern. And I think that these terms are overused and abused and misused. And we shouldn't. And basically what I say is we are looking for explanatory concepts that will help us understand the world around us. Now, it's true that various fields differ in their success in predicting events. So we know that physics and chemistry are pretty good at predicting and developing amazing stuff. Mm. And when it comes to human behavior, we are not very good, or not as good as physicists, but we are just as good as the economists, see?
Mm.
Because looking at the world, you see that the economists are not very good at predicting what's happening in the real world. So we are in good company. And I think that there are certain things that we can predict very, very well when it comes to religion.
Could you tell me about some of
Yes. So I want to focus on some very basic observations that are neglected. And I think that more, we should discuss them more and more often. For example, I say that I can predict a person's religious behavior at age 25 at the moment of birth. Okay, how can I do that? It's very simple. We all know that intuitively. If this person was born a minute ago in India to a Hindu family, okay, 25 years later, he is going to be engaged to some extent with Hindu religious concepts. And this is not a trivial matter. In other words, if we want to understand religion and religiosity, we have to emphasize and realize that it is social learning that creates religiosity. In other words, commitment, a commitment to a particular religion is created by being born into a particular family and then learning certain concepts which become very, very natural. And every individual has certain religious concepts that he considers natural and sometimes reasonable, sometimes true, absolutely true. And when you present that person with religious beliefs from another system, he or she thinks that they are completely ridiculous and absurd and childish. So it's all a question of where were you born and what your parents taught you. Now, some parents nowadays in this world don't teach their children about religion because they are less religious or they are atheists and they don't think it's important. So we can also predict that if you're born into this kind of family, 25 years from now, you're going to be less engaged with religious behaviors and religious concepts. So you see that there are certain things we predict, we can predict, when we observe religion in the real world. And I think it's very, very important. And it's, as I said, it's neglected.
Hmm.
Because very often, see, especially in this country, in the United States, in the United States and in other places, religion is discussed as a matter of choice. Mm. In other words, as if a child is born and then at some point that child is given a menu of 60,000 religions and he or she can choose. No, children are a captive audience. And they don't have a choice about religion any more than they have a choice about the language they learn or the typical food that they are fed. And this is very, very important to remember. And such a basic thing is often neglected. In most textbooks, it doesn't even appear.
Yeah.
You see? And this is, I think, one example of how, by making certain observations, we can make predictions. And this is definitely part of the psychology of religion.
Right. that's quite a big thing,
yeah.
Which seems intuitively sort of, I don't know, obvious, but it's important to empirically show this is the case.
Yeah.
not necessarily for that, but maybe for something else. Could you maybe take us through how you decide on something that you're going to study to do with religion psychologically, and then how you devise a test for that?
Well, one, this is very interesting because there's a great paradox historically in the psychology of religion. I mentioned William James earlier, and William James is especially known for that paradox, which he didn't consider a paradox, but I consider a paradox. Like I said, 99.9% of the believers in the whole world follow exactly what their parents taught them. Now, there's a very small minority of people who convert from one religion to another, okay? So this is a tiny minority, which really, in terms of, you know, the global situation of religion, is not important at all. Because, for example, we have today maybe more than a billion Muslims. We have more than a billion Catholics. We have maybe a billion Hindus. Now, are there a billion Hindus because a billion people decided to convert to Hinduism? No. Very few people decided to convert. However, despite the fact that this is statistically very unusual, it makes us curious. And so for the past century, more than a century actually, since the end of the 19th century, we've been doing research on converts.
Okay.
And if you want me to talk about a specific project, I'll tell you about a specific project having to do with converts. And so there's literature on converts, which is fascinating. And why is it so, first of all, why is it we like converts so much as psychologists? Because converts have incredible stories to tell us, very powerful, very dramatic. See, they have visions, and they hear voices, and they do dramatic things. They do change their lives, okay? A person who was, you know, up to a certain point, a member in a particular religion, switches to another religion and becomes very committed. And we can offer all sorts of hypotheses. And most of the time, these hypotheses are tested after the fact. In other words, we interview converts, or we write about converts, as William James did, after they tell us their dramatic stories, which are always fascinating. So one thing that I decided to do was catch the converts before they're converts.
Right.
How do you do that? And there is such a thing as seekers. There are people who are actively engaged in listening to religious messages, okay, in the sense of and nowadays you have a variety of religious groups that are trying to recruit people, and you have meetings, you have lectures, you have all sorts of things like that. So what I decided to do was look at these people who show up at meetings.
Yep.
Okay, you have a public meeting, and the topic is salvation or the end of the world and the Messiah and you name it. And particular people tend to show up for these meetings. It's not everybody. It's a small minority or a larger minority. So what I did with the help of my students is to hand out questionnaires and do interviews with the seekers, people that, you know, I sent my students out to these meetings.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an evening devoted to, you know, great messages about the Messiah, the end of the world, this and that, or the meaning of life. And the student had to, at the end of the meeting, had to approach one of the participants and get them to agree to an interview.
Yeah. And it's always fun.
So we, over the years, this was going on for a few years, and we got something like 300 or 400 seekers. And then we compare them, which is always a problem, because the problem in research, in psychological research, especially on something like conversion, is a control group. So our control group was university students, which is never a good control group, but that was available.
Yeah.
So of course, the research is never perfect given our lack of resources. And you need huge budgets to do it right.
Mm.
We don't do it in the lab, we can't work with rats, so we have to work with human beings. So basically, what we discovered was that the seekers were indeed, to some extent, similar to the way converts are described in the literature. For example, they had lower self-esteem, and they reported less than ideal relationships with their parents, and they reported having gone through more traumatic experiences, and they, as it is obvious, they reported openness to all sorts of religious and magical ideas. So basically, this is what we did, and this, in a way, validated our notions about. And in recent years, there have been some interest in the notion of seekers, and there is Margit Warburg in Denmark, you know.
Another name.
Yeah, so she has written about seekers, and what she showed was indeed that converts tend to be involved in more than one group when they, you know, they're, let's say, new religious movements, and they go from one group to another, so they are seekers. And I made similar observations in other situations, and that this is what led me to this big study, which was summarized in an MA thesis that, unfortunately, to my great shame, has not been published, and this is really my fault. But this is these are the findings. So this is an example of something. And just to give you an idea of what I think a good study would be, again, on converts, I think that an ideal study would take, let's say, 300 individuals who've had some kind of religious conversion, and as controls, we take their brothers or sisters.
Mm.
You see? But even that is not a good control group, because as psychologists we know that brothers or sisters in the same family don't share the same environment, mm-hmm. because your environment, if you are brother A, your environment includes your brother B. Okay, and if your brother B, so it's never identical, but this would be a good design.
It's the best you're going to get.
Yeah, so this is an example of what I think about when it comes to studying conversion, which is, again, one of the most fascinating topics. But as I said, it's the interest in conversion is in, that's the paradox, is not proportional to its marginality, statistically speaking.
But studying converts would tell you about the people who... You could infer the people who don't convert then from that as well, and you would be able to get access to extremes that you're not going to get in the majority.
That's right, and that's exactly why psychologists have been studying converts, because their religiosity is intense. And for most individuals, and that's another very important fact that people tend to ignore, because of the social learning thing. In other words, you learn your religious identity as a child, and you take it for granted, and you don't invest much in it. Most people don't invest much in their religious identity, even though they own it. Okay, they're going to tell you that, of course, they are Muslims or Catholics, but in terms of everyday life, they don't invest much in it. And the converts, on the other hand, invest a lot in the religious career and do amazing things. again, and they do things that sometimes make a real impression on us and tell us, as I said, very dramatic stories. And so that's why we certainly pay attention to them.
Okay, we're getting close to time.
Okay.
So we'll sort of start to wrap up now.
Yeah.
But although this will be clear to me, it mightn't be clear to our listeners, so I just wanted you to talk about what the psychological study of religion does, if anything, to the supernatural. Can it comment on that? Does it negate that? Does it prove that?
Well, okay. Of course. So the psychological study of religion is by definition naturalistic. In other words, we study what we see, we study things in this world, and we assume the truth is that all academic fields assume what is called methodological atheism. In other words, it's whether it's physics or history or art history or chemistry or political science, we don't involve any claims about the world of the spirits in our work. Okay? And the explanations we offer are always naturalistic. Now, if you're going to write an article in chemistry, and at some point you're going to introduce a supernaturalistic explanation, I don't think people are going to take you very seriously, and they're not going to find it very useful, because the goal is predicting events in this world, or understanding or explaining events in this world, and to say that, you know, this God was on the side of, you know, this party in a particular historical event, doesn't mean much, because it usually is unable to predict. In other words, when the battle is over, you can say that God was on the side of those who won, obviously, but you never know in advance what's going to... So most explanations like this are not very helpful, and people know that. People realize that. And so there's a very clear separation between religious ideas and academic work.
Hmm.
Another thing is that it's obvious that we do have an academic study of religion. We do have this field of academic study of religion because of the process, the historical process of secularization. Because 500 years ago, you couldn't study religion because in those days, 800 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, when universities in Europe were founded, theology was a major field. Theology was the most important thing. And today, theology is non-existent at the university or totally marginal and totally irrelevant to most of what we do. So, of course, we do talk about religion the way we do, whether it's psychology or sociology or anthropology or history, because of secularization. Because the things we say today, 300 years ago, we could still be burned at the stake for, and in some places today, in some Islamic countries today, you'll be beheaded if you say these things, okay? Because religion is still so powerful. So it's a question of political power, and secularization has made our world possible, which is also a very important fact that people tend to ignore.
Yeah.
That everything we do in terms of the academic study of religion is thanks to secularization. And it means that supernaturalist beliefs have already lost much of their power. And that's why we're able to do what we do.
Mm. So on that note, how do religious individuals react to being studied in this way? If they think that's the way they're going to be studied, how do you get them to volunteer?
Okay, it's a problem. It's certainly a problem. And with some religious groups, you'll get no cooperation whatsoever. And you're right. It's I can see their point of view in a sense that it's not, you know, my research is, or somebody's research is not going to be very helpful to them. And this is certainly an issue. It's certainly an issue. And also the other thing that we experience is that when you present some findings, and this is relevant to one finding, especially in the psychology of religion. You know, this is more than 60 years ago. Research was being done in the United States on the question of prejudice and religiosity. And the finding was that there was a positive correlation between religiosity and prejudice. And this gave a lot of trouble to religious people. And when I've had the experience of presenting it in a lecture, and then people coming up to me and saying, but if you're prejudiced, you're not really religious. And that's, what can you say to that? In other words, by definition, if you're religious, you cannot be prejudiced. So this kind, so all we can do is hand out questionnaires.
Yeah.
And see that people who tell us that they believe in this or that are more prejudiced or less prejudiced. That's all we can do.
And I guess whatever you study, you hand it out, you say, here's the research, and then people can say, oh, well, that is my particular God or whatever acting through our biology and our minds.
Oh,
and
sure.
We act and
sure.
Yes. Just to finish up then, we're in quite a sort of crucial time now, sort of really increasing interest in religion ever since, I guess, September 11th, etc. Certainly, I've come to it after that, and there's more and more people starting to study this. What role does the psychological study of religion have to play in the future of the wider discipline, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think that religion is about the human imagination. Okay, so of course, this is psychology. And religion is also about identity and social learning. And identity is very important to people, we know that. And so we can offer our very limited knowledge to the world and see if the world is interested. But if you're talking about political and historical developments, I don't think that our research is going to have any effect on these things whatsoever. So I think it's very important to not to make false promises and not to make false claims, and to understand that when things change in the real world, it's not because of our work or our ideas, and research on religion, academic research on religion, for the past century, whether in sociology or psychology or anthropology or history, has had no effect whatsoever on religions and religiosity. You know, things have changed. We've had more secularization, for example. Mm. But this is not because of us. It's because of powerful forces in society.
Mm.
So that's what we should know, and we shouldn't make any other claims.
Right, wonderful. I'm very sorry to have to stop that there. We could probably keep on going for ages. But Professor Beitalemi, thanks very much.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Well, you've been listening to Chris in conversation with Benjamin Beitalemi. If you found that interview thought-provoking or controversial, please do get in touch. We're keen for the Religious Studies Project to grow into a real community, so we'd love for you to leave any comments, thoughts, criticisms. You can either leave them on the website below the podcast post, or you can start a thread on our Facebook page, but we'd really like to get that conversation going. Well, next week, I'm excited to tell you that we'll be playing my interview with Linda Woodhead, which I recorded during a visit to Edinburgh earlier this year, and she'll be talking to me about the secularisation thesis. I'm sure it's going to be very popular, and it starts off a little thread that we're going to be running over the summer, where we're going to have a few different interviews on the subject of relating to secularism, secularisation. We've got Callum Brown coming up in a few weeks talking about historical approaches to secularisation. And later in the summer, we've got an interview with Tariq Madood, talking about the crisis of secularism and how secularism relates to the state. So the only thing that remains for me to say is thanks for listening.